When Russian forces launched a full-scale military offensive against Ukraine in February of 2022, the majority of the civilized world took a unified position against Russia and in support of Ukraine. The Russian invasion of Ukraine has by far been the most prominent global event in 2022, and the conflict has touched so many facets of so many lives around the world. It's impossible to overstate the lasting impact this event will have on generations to come. From my perspective in the aviation industry, the effects were significant. Since the fall of the Soviet Union, the civil aviation industry in Russia has grown with blistering speed. The first Western-built aircraft, an Airbus A310, began operating with Aeroflot in 1992. And in the 30 years since, thousands of Boeing, Airbus, Embraer, Bombardier, and McDonnell Douglas aircraft have cycled in and out of the collective Russian fleet. As the largest country on the planet, Russia's market is ripe with demand for both passenger and cargo flights. Connecting cities across huge expanses of rugged terrain, and in today's global economy, an equally high demand for international lift connecting people and products with the rest of the world. As is the case for most air carriers in most countries, the economic and operational advantages to aircraft leasing as a source of transport category assets has been heavily utilized in the Russian market. Because of this fact, I've been delivering, transporting, and flight testing aircraft in and out of Russia for as long as I've been in business. Over the years, I've spent a lot of time in Russia, and I've been to more Russian cities than even most Russians that I know. I've been to Moscow, St. Petersburg, Krasnodar, Arkhangelsk, Irkutsk, Magadan, Yakutsk, Anadyr, Vladivostok, Petropavlovsk, and Sakhalin. I've delivered planes to and from Aeroflot, Azur, Smartavia, Yakutia, S7, UTAir, Orinair, Rossiya, and Nordwind. Russia is a very unique place. It's actually a beautiful country, and it's home to dear friends, close colleagues, and even a significant portion of my family tree, beginning as recently as 3 generations ago. It actually makes me quite sad that I may never see her again, at least not for a while. I do believe that cutting Russia off from the greater aviation industry was the right thing to do, and I stand firmly with Ukraine. I also feel for the majority of Russian citizens who will suffer because of the actions of their government. Before I can provide my insight into the current situation and tell the story of the double Russian repo we did at Nomadic, allow me to give you the down and dirty of the concept of aircraft leasing and, specifically, the unique nature of how it was done in Russia. Globally, aircraft leasing is more common in the airline world than aircraft ownership, at least nowadays. With leasing, the aircraft are owned by other companies, the lessors, who generally acquire them from the manufacturers at volume-discounted pricing, leveraging their own equity with bank debt to purchase billions of dollars worth of aircraft. The lessors then market the aircraft to the airlines, which essentially rent them for a period of 5 to 10 years. This type of contract is called an operating lease, or sometimes a dry lease. The airline, who is the lessee, takes delivery of the aircraft and is responsible for registering it in their country of certification. They configure the interior to their standard and paint the aircraft in their colors. The lessee is responsible for maintaining the aircraft during the lease, but there are definitely contractual guidelines set out by the lessor that must be followed. The monthly rental, which is typically anywhere between $100,000 and $250,000 per month for a narrowbody and $300,000 to $550,000 per month for a widebody, generally includes a minimum base number of flight hours per month with operations in excess of that for an hourly rate. The lessors look at aircraft acquisition much differently than the airlines. Because the asset is a long-term investment, the economics of leasing the aircraft need to consider what happens after the aircraft is returned following its lease term. For first-run leases, the lessor normally plans to perform maintenance and then remarket and release the aircraft to a second lease, for another usually shorter term. The lessor may then sell the asset while it's out on its second lease with the lease attached. This is called a stub lease. Or maybe they'll plan to keep the asset to term and then sell it after it's returned. If the asset isn't economically viable at the end of the term, a part-out may be considered. Either way, it's critical to the leasing companies that an aircraft is maintained to a high standard and remains airworthy throughout the course of the lease. Because Russia has always been a high-risk location with regard to airworthiness and maintenance standards, and with regard to default and repo provisions, pretty much all aircraft leased in Russia are, or at least were, registered in Bermuda. This is possible through a bilateral agreement called 83BIS. Simply put, 83BIS is an agreement that allows the airline's local regulator to delegate the task of continuing airworthiness, aka aircraft maintenance, to a regulator in a different country. Until recently, in Russia, the local authority, which is called FATA, regulated the airlines at large, but the maintenance of the aircraft that they operate was conducted in accordance with the higher standard of the Bermuda Civil Aviation Authority. Bermuda operates under regulations called the OTARs, which is a derivative of UK law that covers the British overseas territories. That arrangement worked great for a long time and enabled Russian airlines to thrive. Over the last 20 years, nearly all Russian citizens had access to safe and reliable airline service that connected them with the rest of the world. The Russian leasing market was so good, in fact, nearly all of the largest aircraft lessors on Earth had a significant number of aircraft leased in the country worth billions of dollars. The immediate effect of the sanctions crippled Russia's airline industry. Early on, a few airlines that held out hope of quick resolution and the objective of maintaining a good credit standing cooperated and returned some of their aircraft to neutral locations like the UAE and Turkey. A couple of lessors had a very small amount of success grounding aircraft while turning around in cities in the Caribbean, Mexico, and Southeast Asia. Overall, very few aircraft were ultimately recovered. After Bermuda revoked the registration and airworthiness certificates and insurance companies canceled the policies, most of the Russian airlines, under direction from the Kremlin, illegally deregistered the aircraft and placed them on the Russian registry, effectively stealing billions of dollars worth of Boeing and Airbus passenger aircraft from the lessors. Our double repo mission began in Turkey, where the Russian airline Royal Flight voluntarily surrendered two aircraft right when the sanctions began. In Istanbul, a Boeing 767-300 with Rolls-Royce RB211s, a very rare specimen, and in Antalya, on the Mediterranean coast, a 737-800. Both jets were parked for about a month where the lessor went through the legal channels to deregister and repossess the aircraft ahead of our arrival. Bob and I would split up for the mission. I would grab the 737 out of Antalya with Aiden, and Bob would take the 767 out of Istanbul with Dan. My journey started on the 29th of March when I hopped a flight to Munich, Germany out of Philly. There I connected on Sun Express to Antalya. Aiden met me in Munich after originating in Phoenix. Bob and Dan would fly nonstop from Chicago to Istanbul on Turkish and were slated to arrive a few hours after us. We got in the day before our planned departure in order to get some rest and a nice meal.
We are. Antalya.
Has your dad landed yet? You know?
I don't know.
He must be close.
He's gotta be, right?
Good heck.
Well, after the last year of mainly Pacific and Asia ops, it's really nice to be here in Turkey for a change. We're in Antalya. We arrived just about an hour ago, and our plan is to depart tomorrow. But beautiful here on the Mediterranean. Those mountains in the background, just incredibly beautiful.
Walking down the lively streets of Istanbul tonight. We're staying at the W Hotel, and I don't know what this area is called, but it's near wherever the W Hotel is. Very lively scene, lots of people out. Lots of bars and restaurants in this area. And we're looking for a restaurant right now. Had a nice meal with Dan.
lively place, and then along comes a dog, and he just jumps up here, sits right down next to me, and passes out.
This is just the breads. This is awesome.
While not quite as exciting, Aiden and I also enjoyed our downtime. Bob and I spent quite a bit of the night coordinating with each other on the phone and with our dispatch team, and although the plan was a noon departure the following day, the sun set, as usual, before we ended up heading out to our respective aircraft for departure. The big hang-up for both aircraft was the Turkish CAA. Our paperwork was in order, but it didn't seem to matter as it took hours to get the rubber stamp that we needed. I don't say this figuratively either. We actually needed a document to be rubber stamped. I was literally on the van with Aiden inside the airport gates when we finally got word that our departure permit was granted. Unlike Bob's cushy nonstop leg to Portsmouth, Aiden and I had to make a fuel stop in Keflavik, Iceland, so we had no time to waste. By the time we arrived at the jet, we were airborne within about 40 minutes. Our route of flight between Antalya and Keflavik was anything but direct. We flew a track out over the Med south of Greece and Sicily, passing right over top of Malta, and then over to Tunisia before cutting nearly 90 degrees north up over France and the UK. This was due to overflight permission avoidance. A more direct flight path would have taken us over 10 countries. Each would have then required overflight permissions, and a process which would have delayed our departure for days. We burned more fuel with this route, but the time and money saved was well worth it.
I'm out here in Istanbul, and picking up a Boeing 767 tonight. This one came out of Russia. We were able to get a couple airplanes out of Russia. I'm going to get this one back, repatriated back to the U.S. Currently doing a pre-flight on it, making sure everything's intact, ready to go. We've got about a 12 to 13 hour flight ahead of us.
Once airborne, we were no longer in comms with Bob and Dan, so we assumed they would have taken off out of Istanbul right around the same time as us. We assumed wrong. It took them nearly another 3 hours to get airborne.
So we've been trying to get this airplane out all day. Coming out of here, we have to get permission from the local government. There's a lot of paperwork involved.
Aiden and I flew through the night across Europe, stuffing our faces with pizza and coffee. We kept trying to raise Bob and Dan on air to air, thinking we'd eventually be within VHF range of each other, but that never happened.
It's going to be a long night, long day. And then I showed up, and the catering order was all messed up. They gave us two small little sandwiches after we ordered several sandwiches and coffee. Two small little sandwiches show up for a 13-hour flight. We haven't eaten in several hours, so we're kind of at a dilemma now. Do we wait another hour for more food, or do we get the heck out of here?
We landed in Keflavik and turned on our phones to check their whereabouts, and we found them coasting out just past Ireland. One thing was clear. We stood a real chance of beating them to Portsmouth. Our two most common tech stops for narrowbody aircraft moving between North America and Europe are Keflavik, Iceland, and Shannon, Ireland.
Hey, peace up.
There are several factors which influence this decision, but in most cases, Keflavik wins out due to the simplicity of getting slots and permits on short notice.
Is that stand 6 right there?
I thought
stand 6 was up there.
I don't remember. Stand 6, I think it's over by South Air.
Yeah. That's what I thought.
I've been coming through South Air for years, and they always do a great job turning us around really quickly. I stepped out and did the walk around while Aiden programmed the box and sorted out the paperwork. We were in and out of Keflavik in about 40 minutes. While waiting for fuel to be loaded, I kept looking at Bob and Dan's progress across the North Atlantic on Flight Radar 24 and mentally cross-checking with our planned time across to see if we were going to beat them. No reason for this in particular, I just wanted to win. It was going to be really close, and so close in fact, that we really wouldn't even know who was going to land first until we got there.
Alright, your controls, man. Alright, ready?
It takes about 5 hours to get from Iceland to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and during the day, overflying Greenland can be really scenic. At night, however, the five-hour stretch was long and boring. I rarely even make cockpit casual episodes with trips flown mainly at night, but I made an exception on this trip because it was of interest. The downside to that, though, is just not any usable footage of the Atlantic crossing. Bob did end up beating us to Portsmouth, but not by much. They pulled into the blocks less than 5 minutes before us.
And there's the company 7-6.
There's Bob doing kickoffs.
Just landed in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Pease Air Force Base. There's Nomadic 149 right behind us. We took off in two different places in Turkey, but we ended up landing almost at the same time in Portsmouth. I'm gonna get gas here. They're gonna head to Goodyear, Arizona, and I'm gonna head to Roswell, New Mexico with the 767.
Once we shut down, I was eager to open the door and head over to the 767 to talk to Bob and eat some pizza. Apparently too eager, actually.
What's that?
You want to stay on the plane too quick.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, no problem.
There goes Steve running back to his airplane after busting customs regulations.
Are they going to Goodyear?
Yeah, they're going to Goodyear. And we're going to Roswell.
We are.
Whoops. Guess I got a bit ahead of myself there. After a little while, customs inspected the airplanes, and I headed back over to the 7-6.
Hello, gentlemen.
What's going on?
Nothing. Look at this thing with RB211s. All right, man. Let's, get the fuck out of here, eh?
Yeah, let's get home.
It's really a shitty day here in Portsmouth.
God. I'm ready for the fucking sunshine again.
I'm ready to get on a flight to come back to hell.
The turn in Portsmouth took a while. There were some customs issues to iron out, and said and done, we were on the ground nearly 3 hours before heading out. Bob and Dan went first because they had to make a flight out of Roswell. Aiden and I left about 20 minutes later, bound for Goodyear, Arizona, a western suburb of Phoenix where the airplane would go into storage. While the lessors that were able to recover their assets from Russia were certainly pleased to be in the exception, they definitely still had challenges to deal with as a result of the exodus of Russia from the leasing market. This client suddenly found themselves with two perfectly good aircraft with no customer making lease payments on them. While I'd imagine that a 737-800 will be easy to redeploy, a 767-300ER with RB211s is more than likely a part-out candidate, which is why I assume it was going to Roswell. The The weather beneath us slowly improved until it was completely clear in a million once past the Mississippi River, and the light gave us all second wind, making the final leg of this very long day a piece of cake. In over Winslow, Arizona, we got a real clear view of Meteor Crater. It was around that time I figure Bob and Dan were touching down with Nomadic 150 in Roswell.
Out here in Roswell, New Mexico, just delivered this Boeing 767-300ER. It's one of the airplanes that didn't make it out of Russia. It's now safe back here in the United States. It's going to be parked here in Roswell, New Mexico for a while with a whole lot of company.
So I'm sure you're wondering why I didn't opt to fly the 767, or more precisely, why Bob didn't opt to fly the 737 with Aiden, his son, which finished in Phoenix, the city he lives in. Simple. Travel options. Roswell's a royal pain in the neck to get out of. There are only a couple of flights a day out of there, one goes to Dallas and the other to Phoenix. For Bob, Roswell was just a short 90-minute flight from home, but for me, it meant connecting, likely misconnecting, in the wrong direction to get back to Philly. From Goodyear, it's just an Uber ride to Sky Harbor, where I have five options a day nonstop back to Philadelphia. Simple as that. Aiden and I dropped the 737 off at the MRO in Goodyear and headed home. All in all, it was a pretty painless trip, definitely easier than most repos we get involved with. In this case, our client did all the hard work in advance, which made our lives really easy. By midsummer, only about 20 to 25 aircraft were successfully recovered off lease from the Russian airlines. Of those, we had a hand in about half a dozen, whether we actually flew them or not. What Russia has done here will change aircraft leasing and insurance practices for a generation. Billions of dollars in insurance claims have been paid out to the lessors, and the entire civil aviation industry in Russia is now operating in an unsafe, unsupported, isolated bubble, cut off from most of the world. I honestly don't know if we'll see a return to normalcy in Russian aviation in the next 20 years. Of course, the financial damage is nothing when compared to the senseless loss of life in Ukraine that continues to this day. I truly hope and pray that we're close to some sort of peaceful resolution on that front.